Can't stop her. She's unstoppable.
Now back to the Jenny McCarthy Show, exclusively on SiriusXM Stars.
You want more bacon?
Welcome back to the Jenny McCarthy Show. I'm Jenny McCarthy Wahlberg. This is the topic I have been waiting to talk about for a while now. I had no idea this existed, you guys. Furry expert in furscience.com. I can't even fucking believe there's a furscience.com. Excuse my French. Associate Professor, Renison University College at the University of Waterloo, Dr. Sharon Roberts. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
I don't even know where to start. I don't know if you've heard my show before or even earlier today, but I was talking about my stepson had break it to me that I just bought and made the body of a popular furry. And I said, of course, I know it's a furry. He's nice and fluffy and furry. And he goes, no, it's a furry. It's a sexual fetish. And I literally... my jaw dropped and I freaked out. I didn't know whether these people were trying to control my son, were trying to break through. Is it a perversion to kids or is it just the material? When did this trend of furries begin?
Okay, well, it sounds like it might be useful to describe what a furry is first. So a furry is someone who has an interest in anthropomorphism, which is giving human characteristics to animals. And so furries create a fursona, which is kind of like a persona, but it's a self-created identity. So people who are furries will have a fursona. So other people might cosplay and go to, say, Comic-Con as their favorite character, like Deadpool. But they're actually embodying somebody else's creation. Furries actually make their own fursona, their own identity, and we've actually shown through research that has benefits that translate into real life. So where did this all come from? If you go back to about the 1980s, where you have science fiction fan conventions, there used to be these panels that would happen, and they would have characters from science fiction movies or that had anthropomorphism as a central feature. And so they'd have these panels, and so these people would begin to get to know each other, and then you have the internet, and the proliferation of the fandom really comes from that.
I mean, I'm kind of in shock.
It is shocking for people, yeah.
Now, is there an egoic charge that they get or a sexual charge from it?
Oh, okay. So the biggest misconception out there is that being furry is a sexual fetish. And it's understandable how people have that misconception, because pretty much any interaction that people have had with furries through the media, like the CSI episode, Fur and Loathing, Vanity Fair, Pleasures of the Fur, all of that has been sensationalistic. Now, I mean, we know with any TV show that, you know, the forensics that happen on a TV show are exciting to juice up the storyline. The same thing has happened with the fandom. And so we decided that we wanted to study it scientifically and get to the root of understanding the furry fandom. And what I can tell you is that it is a misconception. Furry is not a sexual fetish. In fact, if I had a kid, if I were in your position and my kid came home and the worst thing they said was, I want to go to a fur convention and be a furry, I'd be high-fiving my husband saying we are home free.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh my God. Just made my day.
Well, you know, I understand. So I run parents panels at some of the fur conventions. So we go to Anthrocon, we go to Canference in Ottawa, it's a new one. We're headed to Euroference in Germany. And we run these parents conventions. I see the fear in the eyes of parents because all they've seen are the CSI episodes and seen the horrible misrepresentation and slander of the fandom. And, you know, I can give them the science on it, which is why we actually created the furscience.com. We've published more than anybody in academia, but most people don't read journal articles, as we all know. So we wanted to, we had funding from our government of Canada and from our school, Renison University College and the University of Waterloo, to create this environment that the public could then learn the facts of the fandom.
I'm so glad you did, because it's definitely educating me on it. Why are they animals? Why aren't they like aliens? You know, why do they choose dogs?
They're fans of anthropomorphism. So those, you know, giving, and this is nothing new. So, you know, you watch a Disney movie and you have anthropomorphized characters. You play Pokemon, you have anthropomorphized characters. And so it's infused with the anime art style. So art is a central feature of the fandom and the community that goes with that. So there's a huge degree of art appreciation that happens when people create their own characters. They like to draw their own characters doing things. And those characters often have, like I was saying, idealized versions of who they want to be. And so it's sort of like a projection of who, you know, the kinds of things that you will like. So we have the world's only longitudinal study in play right now, and we're looking at the differences between personas and fursonas. In the vast majority of cases, the fursona is more sociable, they're more confident, they're a little bit better looking, they usually describe them as, you know, the kinds of things that people would say, oh, I want to be that. And that projection is really useful.
I would imagine. I mean, I definitely understand it, especially when I think about my son. Like, him and his friends do a lot of role playing with like Five Nights at Freddy and all those types of characters. And once they become those characters, they become more confident, more social. It's kind of a weird dynamic that happens. Like, I witness it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the fursona, the most common fursona is actually a hybrid, and some of them get really creative, like a dolphin, muffin, dragon hybrid. The characters will often, like the fursona characters, will often have attributes. So most people who have wolf or canine fursonas will identify loyalty as a character, and foxes will often be, you know, smart and sly. And so the types of characters that people use for fursonas are meaningful to them. So we've done all kinds of research projects. We studied over 20,000 furries from over 70 different countries, and you know, they'll say things like, you know, I have orange glowing eyes. I'm a cancer survivor of 20 years, and so those eyes are the fire in me. They represent the fire in me to survive. And so they have they're infused with bits of the persona, often the parts that they're quite proud of, and then these, you know, idealized trajectories of often who they want to be. So yeah, they're very powerful and they're meaningful. And so when the Social Sciences Humanities Research Council of Canada funded our first project, one of the things that we were looking to do was to establish whether there were identity benefits for this self-created identity, and there are. Compared to, we did a control group of anime fans and sport fans, so fantasy sport fans, and absolutely, it's surprising, maybe to some, but the working through who you want to be and that deep introspective analysis of the self is crucial to becoming an adult, and so we do see that as an outcome.
I find this so fascinating because Evan's always wanted to be the mascot of a school. I'm seeing a major tie-in here of what's going on inside this little boy. I got to ask you, when they meet up, are they allowed to talk? Because mascots usually aren't allowed to speak. So do furries?
Well, it depends on the furry. So a lot of them will not break the magic. So if you go to a convention, if you are not in a fursuit, then you will not be allowed in a place called the Headless Lounge. And the Headless Lounge is where fursuiters and their handlers, because you can't see when you're in a fursuit, they would go into these areas that are private, and they can remove their heads and get cooled down. There's a lot of fans that are going on in there. So, yeah, what else was the question?
I know just if they're allowed to speak or not, but that makes sense.
Oh,
they don't
yeah.
want to lose their magic.
Yeah, and some of them will. Some of them will anyway. But yeah, some of them won't. It just depends on what they're
I know.
They're doing.
Evan won't speak to me during it. He has to take his head off to speak to me. He'll like shake his head a million times, and then he'll take his head off, and then he'll actually speak. Is there an age limit as to when kids get involved or people get involved or
No, actually there's not. So people are typically in their teen years when they develop an interest in furries. And because we work with American partners and they have stricter regulations on ethics and doing research, we can't study people who are under the age of 18. But with retrospective questions, we find out that Furries know that there's something in them that's it's interesting, that they have this interest in anthropomorphic art at about the age of 16, and then by 17 they discover the fandom. And so there's this year in between that we haven't studied that we're really quite curious about, you know, what's going on when you know that you have this interest that's uncommon, but you don't yet know that there's an entire group of people who share this interest. So yeah, the ages typically are teenagers, although I have seen children that come with their fandoms, like a little family of skunks in Texas. It was very cute. The mom and dad and little baby skunks all dressed up. And then you have a group that sometimes self-identify and some don't like the label of gray muzzle. And gray muzzle, the fandom's filled with really cute and sort of punny kinds of terminology. Gray muzzles are defined as people who are either over the age of 30 or have been in the fandom for more than 10 years. And so you have people who at Anthrocon, for example, in Pittsburgh, which is the largest convention on the planet, you have people who are in their 80s that are going to furry conventions and have been furries their entire lives. And you can imagine that would have been much more difficult back when there really was no internet or no community.
Exactly.
To support
can you
it.
Imagine those poor people that had to always start the first wave? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I see them on YouTube, they seem like a Barney's, you know, show or something like that. It's really tailored towards kids comedy. Is that for a reason? Is the reason behind it to be popular, to gain viewers?
Furries will, yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that one of the things to know is that only about 20% of furries actually have fursuits. The rest of them, like 50%, might wear ears or tails, and a bunch of furries will not have any sort of external representation. It's something that's personal to them. They might have a badge that has their fursona drawn and the character drawn, but that would be it. I mean, one of the things that we would ask is, you know, if there is sort of like a childlike appreciation for this community, you know, we might ask the opposite question, like why is it essential that people lose that desire to have fun in their adult years? And most of the time, it's not necessarily childish. It's just people who are embracing creativity, and you know, they're having a good time with it, and they're representing themselves in ways that make them comfortable and happy.
Dr. Sharon, will you marry my son?
Well, I have a husband.
I mean,
let me tell you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, really, if your kid is a furry and this is it, you're home free. This is okay. I mean, it's really nothing to worry about. I do understand how people don't know about it because it's hard to compete with CSI when you're a startup academic, you know, with firstscience.com. You know, it's hard to get the reach that CSI would or Vanity Fair, but we are tenacious. We are trying.
I got to tell you, just you educating me right now and making complete sense on the creative side of it makes me feel 100% better. Not a little better, 100% better. And I've never stopped Evan from like wanting to do what he wants to do creatively. He's very creative.
Yeah.
And now I just feel more excited to watch where he takes this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I would say the following to any parent. If you have, you know, a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old who wants to go to a convention, the same rules apply that they would if you were going to Disney World. Anytime you get 7,000 people in a hotel room together, whether they're furry or not, they might be hotel staff, there's always a chance for somebody who's going to do something that's not ideal. And that's just a product of numbers. So, I mean, the regular rules apply. You know, you want to make sure that you're with people that you know and that, you know, you know where your kid is. You know, don't be too trusting. But it's the same thing. I mean, as far as, you know, the hookups go, when I was working with the diabetes team and go to medical conventions, the hooking up was far more prevalent in doctors' conventions than it was at furry conventions. Furry conventions are people running around and they're happy and they're hugging and, you know, we actually just wrote a paper on post-con depression, and there's actually a phenomenon that happens, and maybe this is something to be aware of for your son. After your son comes home from a convention, he actually might experience a really big letdown after being in such a happy place, and so that's something to, you know, just be, you know, mindful of.
That's good to know. But then again, that scares me too. Or maybe I just have to educate him that might happen. Maybe knowing about it
Yeah,
ahead of
well, I
time.
Yeah, I mean the thing is that what seems to mitigate that is connections with people. So we do see a number of consequences of going to them. Most people love going to conventions and they have great times. They feel sad when they're done because, like being on vacation and you're back at work, it's
Course.
exactly the same thing. And so, just being mindful that, that's a normal expression, as would it be with anybody else who's going to work and after they've come home from a vacation. But the connections that they make, some furries report post-con that they ride that high for a long time and they keep those memories. A lot of furries will save up their money because they are young, typically. They'll save up their money their entire year, and going to a convention becomes their major vacation. And so, they look forward to it all year long and they make friends that they report have changed their lives. So when we do studies of comparisons of furries with population levels, we see no differences in depression or anxiety or any well-being measures. They're basically the same as population level, but they have this extra benefit. Now, the one thing that we do see, there are two things that we see a difference with. The first one is autism spectrum. We see
I was going to
disproportionately
ask.
high levels of autism spectrum in the fandom, and LGBTQ, 70% LGBTQ, and bullying in history. But those kinds of things would all fit together if you think about it.
Yeah, that was my
When we
next
do the
question is like, what
research,
kind of people have you researched? Do they have a diagnosis and maybe what
Well,
kind of
yeah, I
person
mean,
they are?
basically those things. But here's the thing. In spite of all those things, these people thrive in this community. So, I mean, think about the things that really make a difference to people. It's support and friendship and community. And we live in a highly individualistic society. And this group creates an incredible support for its members that, to me, is hugely beneficial
Well, you
to
know, I
them.
mean, now
Now,
that I think
it.
about it, him and his friends that might be on the spectrum, because he's a lot of kids' friends on the spectrum, they who, you know, don't like eye contact that much. They're not great communicators, but they want to be friends. And so I can see where this could morph into a great way to be social without having and feeling like you're part of something without having to have lots of eye contact, a lot of communication.
Well, yeah, and that was actually one of the papers that we wrote in Health and Social Work. It was specifically for clinicians. So while there's no difference in anxiety and depression, we all know in regular society there's a lot of that. And so inevitably, someone who's furry will go into practice and, they'll say, well, my boyfriend sucks and my parents are awful and, there's this furry drama going on. And the clinicians are going, back up. What was that last part? You need to get rid of that. Not realizing that the furry component of their life might actually be the only source of positivity in their life at that time. And so we, after doing this research, we directed a paper specifically at clinicians so that when they encountered anthropomorphic phenomenon or identities in their practices, that they would understand what it was. We needed it to be in the peer-reviewed literature for them to access it. And so, yeah, what we do see are tremendous benefits. I mean, what I really want to stress is that furries are just like you. Actually, that was the name of our campaign. We did this little PSA, tongue in cheek, for the public, where we had furries doing ridiculous, mundane things like parking a Volvo or going wine tasting. Of course, they don't do this stuff in their fursuits. But we made these five little videos to launch this anti-stigma campaign, so that people would just get the facts on furries. And yeah, it was incredible. But furries are really just like you, and so you're going to have a lot of people who are going through life with the regular kinds of challenges, and you're going to have some like regular life that are going to have additional challenges. And what I can tell you is that the ones that we have spoken to who have additional challenges, the fandom is an incredible source of positivity for those people. So
That makes complete sense.
furries aren't broken people, but when furries just like you do experience challenges, the community is really beneficial to them.
I absolutely love this. And you know what? It was meant to be that I talked to you today so I can help spread the word. That's why I love this platform for any other parents. And it's something I'd actually want to introduce to the community. You know what I mean? I'm going to have you talk to somebody at my organization also, because if it's a big spectrum kind of a thing, and it's good for them. I'd rather have parents know than not know. Dr. Sharon Roberts, thank you so much. If you guys want more information, go to Fur Science. That's FURScience.com. That's the correct place, right, Dr. Sharon?
That's it. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course, what a pleasure. I have a feeling I'll be talking to you again really soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Jenny.
Very enlightening. We'll be right back.
A braided chain made of finest silver from the north of Spain, a locket that bears the name of a man that Brandy loved. He came on a summer's day.
Stop tugging at your bra straps and second guessing your size. It's time to put fit first with Third Love. Third Love uses women's real measurements and super smoothing memory foam to create bras that fit better and are more comfortable. They offer sizes from AA to G. Wow. As well as their exclusive half cup sizes. Just answer a few simple questions online and Third Love will recommend a bra in the right size and style for you. Now Third Love is offering you a chance to try one of the perfect 24/7 bras for free for 30 days. Just pay $2.99 for shipping and you're on your way to a perfect fit. You'll get to really live in this bra. Feel free to wash it, wear it all day. You might even forget that you're wearing it. If Third Love isn't your new favorite bra, just return it or exchange it for free. Go to thirdlove.com/Jenny now to get your perfect Third Love bra. Try it for 30 days. That's thirdlove.com/Jenny to try your new favorite bra for free. Thirdlove.com/Jenny.